Breathe. Hi, everyone. My name is Angela, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you so much for, let's see, Billy. Yeah. See, this podium is a little tall for me. Is there a stool I can stand on? No, I'm just kidding. I'm really kidding. I think last time I was here, you did have me stand on a stool. Thank you for asking me to come out. I really do appreciate it. And I appreciate the time also to be able to just kind of meditate in the car, because I've had a whirlwind of a weekend and it's been fabulous, but I needed that downtime to myself in the car to, you know, regroup and reconnect, you know, with my creator. Like you talked about in that reading that you did before the meeting, I didn't realize it, but my journey through AA was really going to be about me connecting with a higher power that I could learn to trust, and that was how I was going to stay sober. And, I didn't know that was what was going to happen, but now that that's how I maintain, this life that actually is pretty full of joy and freedom, and it's a good way to live. Now that I have this way of life, when I start neglecting the quiet time and the reading and the prayer and the meditation, it starts to show up and things start to become unmanageable and uncomfortable, and I start to get that restlessness that I get irritable probably is first, that comes first usually, discontent, and all those things are talked about in our literature, that those are feelings that we have, and I had that when I was young, and that's when I first took a drink. And, you know, I didn't want to drink when I was younger. I knew that alcoholism was in my family. I knew that my parents fought about my father's drinking, so that I didn't want to drink. I knew that one of my grandfathers, you know, they said he was an alcoholic. I never knew him. They said he died young, or not young, but he died earlier than he should have because of alcohol. And so I really didn't want to drink. But when I had this experience in high school where my mother, it was right between the 10th grade and the 11th grade. And you know, gosh, you know how high school is when everything is just about your friends and popularity. And if you get invited out or you get a date to prom or get a, you know, it was so wrapped up in all that. And I was so on track. You know, I was playing the game. I was making the grades. I had the boyfriend. I was checking all the boxes in high school. And in the middle of all me thinking things are great, my mother says, "We're moving and you have to change schools. And, you know, I'm going to be the new kid." And I thought my life was just like over. You know, I really thought that. I mean, it was very devastating. I mean, I was like captain of the cheerleading squad. And I was really doing a lot at school. And I love school. I was kind of a latchkey kid. My mom was never home. She worked very hard. She built a business for herself. She had a house at the beach. And, you know, many times on Friday, I got home from school and there was just money on the table that said for groceries and, you know, see you Sunday night. And that was fine with me. I liked that, you know. But when she said, you know, "We're moving and you have to change schools," you know, I felt like she had, you know, betrayed me, that my whole life would just be, the rug was being ripped out from underneath me. So she takes me to see the house, right? That I don't drink. At this point, I was not drinking. I tried to like smoke marijuana with people, but that made me so uncomfortable. And I would always, I got really it wasn't fun for me. It was just made me paranoid and want to eat mayonnaise and crap like that. I mean, this was back in the 80s. It wasn't like now. I believe now it's become, you know, more of like a better product, so to speak. But back in the 80s, it wasn't for me. So she said she's going to take me to see this house, and it's New Year's Eve, and they had champagne. And she brought a bottle of champagne in the car with us to drive over to see the new house. And so it's probably, it's not midnight, but it's late. It's probably like after nine, and we had a really nice dinner, and we go to drive over to this house. And in the back of the car, I have the champagne, and there probably was more than one bottle, but because she's one of us too, by the way. I started drinking the champagne in the back of the car. And the ride was probably maybe 25, 30 minutes over to the new place. And she shows it to me, and I was drinking the champagne in the back of the car. But then she drives me around to like the other corner of the house. And she says, "Now look what's right down the street." And we walk out on this beautiful like dock with all these sparkling lights. And, you know, the champagne had started to come into my body, and it was warming me up. And I just got this feeling all over that like life was going to be okay. And that this big move that earlier that day I thought was the end of my life, now my perspective was, this is the beginning of a new and beautiful life, you know? And what I found was alcohol just changed my perspective. So, and over and over again, that was my experience with it. So I would be really mad at my boyfriend, or mad at my friend or my mother, but, you know, I'd have a few drinks, and then I'd say, "Oh, that was nothing. You know, I didn't really have a good reason to be mad at you. Our relationship is too important for, you know, that kind of menial tit for tat stuff. And I really love you. We really should be friends," or "we, you know," whatever it is. And, you know, that was even true with my marriage, you know. So later in life, I'd get all upset about something like, "Now, this is true. We had a garden. My husband went and picked the zucchini, and I was so proud of this garden, but he went and picked the first zucchini." And I was like a little upset because I wanted to be the one to pick the first zucchini, because I put a lot of work into that garden. And he brought it in, and he began to cut it up, and he cut it in the wrong direction. And I got so mad and so upset about the direction of how he cut up the zucchini. I mean, that's an alcoholic person who hasn't had a drink yet. Then you give me a drink, and I'm like, "Oh, that was silly, honey. You know, I shouldn't have been mad about the way you cut that zucchini." And I mean, but, you know, alcohol helped me to actually, I don't know, it just changed my perspective. And it changed my perspective on myself too, because like, I could think I was awkward. I could maybe go into a party and feel, you know, nobody likes me. I really shouldn't be here. I'm, you know, whatever. Then I have a few drinks and I feel like, "Oh, look at my hair. I'm doing, look at me dance." You know, it changed my perspective on me. There was just, it was magical, you know, for me, it was magical. I felt more at ease. I felt more at peace. I felt like at one with God and others. Like, we're all friends here. You know, life is good. Well, you know, yes, we're going into bankruptcy, but we'll figure that out tomorrow, right? It was all, you know, we'll figure that out tomorrow. It'll be okay. And gosh, I mean, that's not a bad way to think. You know, that's not really a bad way to think. It's just that the means to get to that way of thinking were killing me. And the means to get into that way of thinking were actually preventing me from ever having that everything's going to be okay in the end. So I went away to college. I went to Georgia. And I wanted to get far away from home. Georgia was one of the top 10 party schools. You know, that's where REM was. I mean, this was the late 80s. It's where I wanted to be, B-52s and all that. And some things started happening down there that clearly, I mean, I didn't know that this was alcoholic, but clearly it was. I'd go just to a friend's house, and oh, this was probably, probably in Virginia as well. And there'd be a party, right? There'd be alcohol at the party. And I'd do things like open the fridge, count up what's in there, hide a few, right? Hide one in the butter dish, hide one under the carrots, like down in the freshener, if there was any food in the refrigerator. I'd hide beers around the refrigerator so that it, when we did run out and they had to go to the store to get more, there would still be something for me and I'd know where it was. The butter dish, you know, little that, that's where it was. And that worked, it really did. But I always had to protect the supply, you know? So it would be maybe quarter of 12 and it, you know, it's last, you can't buy anything at the store after quarter of 12, usually something like that. And we'd have usually plenty to drink, but I'd say, oh, we better run up to the store real quick and get, you know, make sure go get some more, get another 12 pack. And my husband would say, well, we have, you know, we still have six here, you know, we're good. And I'd say, well, you know, maybe we won't drink them, but at least we'll have it for tomorrow, you know. But then if they were in the house, though, I was going to keep drinking. I mean, I was going to drink until I was passed out or we ran out. Now, that got a little more difficult, though, as I had children. Let's see. I'm trying to think if I want to tell you anything about high school. So, okay, well, there was alcoholic behavior in high school. Here's how I would describe it. I couldn't drink every day, right? I could barely get alcohol for like one night, but I would plan it all week long. I would be calling people. Who do you know? What store can we go to? Who has an ID? So I was always planning how we were going to get alcohol for Friday or Saturday. Then we would get it. And then I'd make sure that I got more than everyone else. And then sometimes people would have to find me because I'd be passed out in the backyard of someone's house at a, you know, party. And that didn't happen every single weekend. But when we did have enough alcohol, like a bottle of tequila or, you know, someone who could buy a lot of alcohol, that is what happened. So the only reason it didn't happen more often is that we usually didn't have that much to drink. And I could really, I mean, I could tolerate a lot. I had a friend of mine and we would always have a 12 pack, I'm not a 12, a six pack. And we'd say, oh yeah, this is for us, three and three. And then she'd drink two and go, I'm done. And so I got four. And it was always like that. I mean, I always seemed to drink more than whoever I was with until I started to be able to find my people, right? Because then once I got to Georgia and I had no parental control, I had a fake ID. I made sure to get a really good fake ID. It was really important to me to have a really good fake ID. So I had a friend who was adopted and I took her adoption papers to the DMV and I got a real actual driver's license. It's probably illegal to do this. I got a real actual driver's license using her adoption papers at the DMV. I mean, it was like you couldn't, I mean, it was a real Virginia driver's license. And it was perfect. It was perfect. So I took that to Georgia and, you know, things started to happen. Now, I never wrecked a car, never got a DUI, but I wrecked a bicycle in Georgia. That was messy. And, you know, I didn't mean for that night to get out of control at all. I was out. I rode my bike into the city. I was just going to ride it home and cook dinner. But there was at the Uptown Lounge, they had $2 margaritas. And I mean, gosh, what a deal, you know. And then I would get on my bike to ride it home. And I mean, I couldn't ride a bicycle, you know, had a few too many $2 margaritas. And, you know, at this time I'm really only like, I don't even think I'm like 20 or 20, maybe I'm 21 by now, but I'd only been drinking for 3 years. You know, I'd only been drinking for such a short amount of time, but yet I consumed so much alcohol. And I would get up in the mornings and I would try to go to class. I would have a Coke And this girl in Georgia showed me this trick where you take a Coca-Cola and you dump peanuts into it. And you have like kind of like a snack and a drink, because all in one, because you weren't allowed to take food into the classrooms, but you could take a drink. And she said, oh, you just, this is what we do in Georgia. We put our peanuts in our Coke. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. So I would start doing that. And peanuts are really good at covering the smell of liquor. So it really helped with the smell of the liquor. I'm looking for my drink. So that would get me through class. You know, I managed to make it to classes. I mean, I graduated with a reasonable GPA in high school. I was able to pull somewhat of an okay GPA in college. But as I went through, so I was starting off in my freshman and sophomore year, I was doing things like number one in the class. I was making like the highest grades in some of my classes. And then by the time I got to my senior year, I was lucky to pull a C in a class. And just in that short amount of time, the alcoholism really progressed. You know, I didn't know that's what was happening when I was in it, in the middle of it. I didn't know that alcoholism was progressive. I didn't even know that's what I had. I just thought I liked to relax. I didn't know that I had alcoholism. So fast forward, we get to Virginia. I get married. I have two children. I'm trying so hard to put together a life that makes sense, right? We joined a church, and I'm singing in the choir. I'm doing mom's Bible study every Monday morning. I'm teaching the two-year-old music class on Wednesday nights. Let's see, what else did I do? It seemed like we were at church about four times a week. And this was one of the things that I was doing to not drink. It's like I was trying to fill my life up with all these things that were good things so that I wouldn't drink, because I really wanted to be a good mom, a good wife, a good member of my community. And I was just, I mean, you should see, I had this big calendar and it was all color coded, and it was purple and red and green and blue, and all the colors had different meanings and different priorities. And it was just, most of it was just to keep me so busy and so that I would feel just okay enough with myself to not drink. Because when I was, let's say my first child, I didn't drink at all during the pregnancy, but after he was born, I picked it right back up again. With my second child, I didn't drink during the pregnancy, but I mean, as soon as she, and I thought, this is it. I'm not going to be a drinker anymore, right? I'm not going to be a drinker anymore. I'm going to be a mom now. I'm going to be a wife now. I'm going to, you know, like, I didn't think I was going to be a drinker. I kept thinking, I'm going to grow out of that. I just thought I was going to grow out of it. I thought I was going to mature, and it was going to be just a chapter of my life where, oh, that was me when I was in my early 20s, and now this is me in my late 20s. And it was so odd, because by the end of the day, I would get so just tense, wound so tight, and I just needed that thing, just that release to be okay. I think that's when I got to the point where alcohol ceased being a luxury and started becoming a necessity, because I couldn't really get my brain to, like, I couldn't lay down in the bed, put my head on the pillow and go to sleep. My brain would just like and remember this, and remember that, and you should have said this, and next time you'll say this, and if he says that, you say this, and if she says this, you do this, and then, I mean, and my brain would just be talking to me all night. And even about things that were like 20 years ago, which is the oddest thing. I mean, like, that 20 years ago, remember what you said about those pants you had on, and remember how you felt. And she, I mean, crazy, crazy thoughts laying in the bed at night, you know, and alcohol fixed that for me. So when the kids got a little bit older, when I stopped breastfeeding my daughter, I started drinking again. And I had this routine with them that I kind of built their bedtime and everything to match up with when I wanted to start drinking. And so they had pretty early bedtimes, right? And we got this like 3-minute bedtime storybook where I could do a bedtime story in 3 minutes, you know? And then I'd give them they usually wanted something to eat. And so I just had this plan. Here's your banana, here's your water. You had your story. I would sing like 2 songs and tickle their back. And I'm like, I had this little routine that I do. So because I needed to be a good mother, but I also needed to drink to go to sleep. It's neither one of my children, after I got sober, they couldn't remember me ever being drunk. But there were times that they would come outside because I would be outside smoking cigarettes, drinking a beer. And they'd come outside and I'd say, I'd say, this is my time, remember? You know? And there's a story in the book that was really heartbreaking to me to read because it talks about the message that I'm sending my children is, I love you, now go away. And how confusing that is to a child to be told the words, I love you, but then to be given the actions, you're not important to me right now, you know? And outwardly, you wouldn't say that was abuse, but inwardly that is abuse. It confuses a child when your words are saying, I love you, but your actions are saying, go away. I don't have time for you right now. This is my time. You're not my priority right now. And it's just very confusing. And it is an abusive thing to do. I was trying so hard to do all the right things in all the other areas. So in the mornings I'd get up and I'd be hungover and sometimes even dry heaving. But I'd show up at the school to volunteer. I'd make the kids' lunches. They'd have their, you know, sandwiches cut in little shapes, a little I love you note, the carrot sticks, the whatever, the nice, healthy lunches every morning. My breakfast was generally the crust off of the sandwiches that were cut in the cute shapes. And then I'd go up to the school to volunteer. And I remember when Lillian was in kindergarten. The teeny, teeny, tiny little toilets were in the kindergarten room. And I went in there to volunteer one day and I was dry heaving that day. It was a day that I had overindulged the night before, which is usually probably at least once or twice a month, I would have this horrible thing happen where I would be dry heaving all day long, like till 8 o'clock the next night. And this was one of those days. But I still wanted to show up because see, if you start missing things because of your drinking, you might have a problem with drinking. So I wouldn't miss anything. I'd show up in whatever condition I was in. And so I'm in the bathroom just trying so hard to be, these toilets were like 12 inches off the ground and I'm sprawled across the floor, you know, trying to aim into that toilet and, you know, it was so miserable. That kindergarten teacher knew something was wrong with me. And I remember she was such a kind woman and my daughter adored her. And when I was leaving that day, she kind of grabbed my hand and held it like just the extra minute and said, take care of yourself, you know, like that. Just take care of yourself. And something just resonated with me with that, okay, I'm not fooling anyone. She's saying she knows that I'm sick. And then another thing that happened, this all kind of happened within about a 3-month period. And I was 30, I was probably 35 or 36, right? I came in, I was 36. So these things were happening when I was about 35 years old. Right now I'm 51. So don't worry about math. I'll just tell you. It was about 35, 36. So my daughter was in kindergarten. My son was in third grade. The teachers in my son's class, I had this little meeting with them and they said, your son is drawing everything in black and brown. He's used up all the crayons in the room. he goes to the next room and takes all of their black and brown crayons. And like, apparently he was taking everybody's, he only would draw in black and brown. And they're like, there's something wrong with that. And I don't know what they were saying, but, and so I got home to my husband and we were talking about it, and I just kind of put it to prayer. And I was like, you know what? I need to stop trying to fix other people. I think this is about, I need to just look at me. What's wrong with me? You know? And I don't know how that turned into me going to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was just one more thing. It was one more little hint, one more little flag that said, you need to look at what you're doing. You need to look at yourself. You need to look at your behavior. And I'm thinking, there's nothing wrong with him drawing. He just wants to draw in black and brown because he always draws Transformers and they're all black and brown. I mean, that's just what he was drawing, was all black and brown stuff. And I don't think it had anything to do with anything. You know, they just were teachers being, you know, teachers about the black and the brown. Maybe he stole some crayons. I don't know. They went through so many crayons. I sometimes thought they were eating crayons, because I mean, every time I turn around, they said, we know your child needs more crayons. But my son was also an artist, so he used a lot of crayons. So I went, one of my friends, it was my mother, actually. I'll go ahead and break her anonymity. She was picking up a 30-day chip. And I had no idea what she's talking about when she said she was going to pick up a 30-day chip. She said, would you like to come with me? I'm going to be picking up a chip today. And I didn't know what she was talking about. I didn't know what she was doing. So I go with her, and, you know, everybody's sitting at this table. It happened to be like it was a step meeting. It was like maybe third step meeting or something. But everyone was talking about things that I was going through at this meeting. It was, you know, it was an AA meeting. They were talking about not wanting to drink, but drinking anyway. They were talking about sitting down at the bar to have one drink, or thinking they were going to have one drink and then not remembering the end of the night. It's like, oh, they, you know, like they were, it was like they were just describing all these things that I had never told anyone. I didn't even think I had told my mother any of this. In fact, I'm pretty sure I hadn't. So I was wondering how she knew to tell them to talk about that stuff. Because I really thought that somehow she was actually, you know, and this is that paranoia, right? I thought that she had brought me there for me. She didn't even know I was having these problems with alcohol, but, you know, alcoholism had made me very paranoid and made me think that everything had to do with me. Maybe that's still going on a little bit. I was a little upset, like a little taken back, but I was also fascinated. I was just fascinated with these people that were so honest. I had never heard anyone just talk about themselves so freely and openly and just without being embarrassed and it was just amazing to me. And so we went for lunch after, and then she asked me if I wanted to go back with her again. And I said, yeah. So I think I went back one more time. Now, remind you, when I'm showing up at these things, I'm probably smelly. Like they probably could smell the alcohol from the night before on my breath, because I typically drink late. So if I, you know, didn't start drinking till like 8, I would drink until like, you know, midnight or 1. I mean, I drink a lot in a short amount of time to get to sleep. And if I didn't, oh, here's another trick. If I knew I needed to get up really early, like for a field trip or something, I would take 2 Benadryl at like 8 o'clock. And that way I would drink a beer or maybe start a second one. And then I'd be like, I mean, I could barely make it to the bed, right? I mean, I would just pass out. And so that was a way that, and they talk about this in the book. They said, have you ever used drugs to manage your alcoholism? And I'd say, no, I'm never, you know, I don't use drugs. But that was a way that I was using a drug. the Benadryl to manage the alcoholism. Because then if I took the two Benadryl, I couldn't drink that night. And then I would get up on time and go to the field trip, but we have to be at the bus at 7 a.m., whatever. And so I did have to use medication to manage the alcohol. And then I also used caffeine to manage the hangovers, right? And so every time I tried to say something to my sponsor, like, oh, no, I never did that, she'd say, no, let's think about that. If it said you never drank in the morning, I'd say, oh, I never drank in the morning. She'd say, well, let's think about that. Because then it was revealed to me that, oh, yeah, when you swallowed that Listerine at the dentist's office so that you would stop dry heaving, that was drinking in the morning. Because I did work for a dentist for a short amount of time. Well, not really, like 10 years. I worked for a dentist and I would show up. We had their morning huddle was at 7:30 a.m. And I would be hungover from the night before and I would start dry heaving. Well, I didn't realize I was in withdrawal, You know, I needed more alcohol. And so I would go in the bathroom and we always had Listerine in all the rooms. And I'd just rinse with some Listerine and then I'd swallow a little bit and I would stop dry heaving. And I was like, oh, that's a trick. I have to, you know, put that trick in my pocket and remember it, because I didn't realize that that little bit of alcohol was what my body was like, give me, give me, give me. And when I gave it that little bit, it would just, I would calm down. It would calm down my stomach. It would calm down my nerves and I could get back to work. And, you know, I wasn't in the bathroom like chugging it, but I was in there treating my alcoholism with Listerine, you know, which has alcohol in it. So another thing about the dentist's office that I would mention is that the lady sometimes will go out for lunch. And in the manual at the dentist's office, it said that you could have one drink at lunch. This was, you know, in the manual was probably written in the late 70s, 80s, and it said you could have a drink at lunch. And that's what they did. But, and I went out for lunch with the ladies and they said, well, Angela, we're all going to have a drink because the manual says we can have a drink at lunch. And I would say, I don't think I want to have a drink. I'm just, you know, I'll just, maybe after work, I'll have a drink. Because I knew that if I drank that one drink, I was going to get really thirsty. You know, I knew that if at lunch, which was, I think we had lunch from like 1 to 2 or something, like maybe it was a pretty late lunch. I knew that I was probably not going to work that afternoon, you know, because when I have that one drink, it just flips a switch. And I'd rather just not drink at all than have that flip, that switch be flipped and me be uncomfortable all afternoon feeling thirsty for a drink, because that's how I'd feel. I'd feel thirsty. And so rather than have a drink with them, I just would not, you know, even though it was in the manual that you could have one drink at lunch. So they were funny. It was fun to work there, but I also had to use my peanut trick at the dentist office. So I'd go in there and I'd be all hungover and stinky, and I'd eat celery with peanut butter in it because the peanut butter masked the smell of the alcohol. And that was a trick that I used a lot. I went to go to mom's Bible study and they're like, why are you always eating celery with peanut butter? Is that your favorite breakfast? Oh yeah, that's my favorite breakfast. Celery with peanut butter, you know, but it would mask the smell. It was just, you know, all these things I did to like try to control and manage. And I got really tired. I was exhausted. So by the time that I was in that AA meeting, it was a 12 noon meeting. And I was so tired. I was just running around like crazy. I had like these two different lives going on. I had this, you know, life after bedtime, you know, so life after 7:30, where I just drank myself silly, right? And then I'd get up at 7 in the morning and start trying to live this normal life, like say from 7:30 to 7:30. So I had this 12 hours of me being this responsible, ultra busy, responsible mom, you know, working part-time for a dentist. And then I'd have the other 12 hours of me being the lush, alcoholic housewife, you know, who, I mean, there just wasn't enough for me to drink. I was so tired. And so I got it. It was a Thursday morning. And I thought, oh, I think I'm going to go to that meeting. And I called my mother and she was out of town. And I went to the meeting by myself. And I just wanted to listen to what they were saying again. You know, I just wanted to listen to what they were saying. I just wanted to hear it again. Like, are they really, like, are they going to say the same thing today that they said the last time? You know, I was looking for inconsistency. I was looking for a loophole. I was looking for someone to say something that I didn't like. They talked my thoughts again. They talked about how I felt. They were feeling the same way I was feeling. They talked about funny things that had happened in their lives. And I had similar things happen in my life. And at the end of the meeting, they did the 9-step promises. And that's what I really wanted to hear again, too, because I'm like, I was amazed by the 9-step promises. I just felt like, I thought that's like, those are miracle words. You're talking about miracles. You know, I've been just going to church and doing Bible study. And I mean, I had been praying to God to make me not want to drink. But none of it had been working. So I figured I'm just supposed to drink, because if I'm praying to God and saying, God, please make me not want to drink, and I still want to drink, then I must be meant to drink. And it was this weird place where I was, where I just was almost an acceptance of my alcoholism. I'd come to a place where I accepted that I was just going to be a drinker, and that's just the way it was going to be. And I just needed to manage it. Like, that's where I was. And in this meeting, they were doing the chips. And I really did not want to pick up that first white chip. I didn't want to not drink for the rest of my life, you know? I didn't want to join. I didn't want to do that. But it was Bob S., you know, tall Bob, held up the chip, and it wasn't me. And I mean, I know this is one of those things where they say a divine intervention took place, because I just got up and picked up the chip. And I'm like, you know, did someone like push? Like, I really didn't feel like that I was picking up that chip. I did not want to pick up that chip, but I picked up the chip. I got up and picked up the chip. And we talk about God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. And that's one of now many examples of where my thinking has gotten more in line with God's will. Because I don't think I was in a place at that time that I was praying for God's will, because I was scared that God's will was that if I said, God, what would you have me be? And what would you have me do? I really thought that meant that God would send me to Ethiopia to be a missionary. You know, I thought it was going to be something really extreme, you know, and I didn't think it was going to be something simple like, just don't drink today, right? Just don't drink today. That's it. Just today. And so I picked up that white chip, and I just burst into tears crying, because I was like, you know, what does this mean for me? You know, like, what does this mean? And everyone, you know, surrounds me and, you know, gives me phone numbers. And I think that's crazy. And all those phone numbers and stuff. And I make it a week with just dry, what do you call it? White knuckling it a week. And then the next Thursday, I think, I don't know, maybe, you know, I don't know. It's Thursday. It's practically the weekend. I'm going to have a beer. My husband, there was beer in my house all the time, right? And I said, I'm just going to have a beer. And so I drank one Coors Light. And then I think I probably had 14, you know? And I really didn't mean to. I think that I just was going to have the one, or maybe I was going to have two. But no, it just spun out just like that. And I was like, wow, they're right. They were right. once I flip that switch, once I take that first drink, I can't turn it off. I mean, and I have every reason to not drink. I mean, and I knew that I'd even made this big list of all the reasons why I shouldn't drink and how my life would be so much better if I didn't drink. You know, logically, I knew I shouldn't be drinking. But I also knew there was a part of me that I didn't understand that had to drink. And that's that part where the book talks about it's baffling and it's powerful. And I was baffled by that in myself. And it was more powerful than I was. And so that Thursday I overindulged again. And Friday went to a meeting in the morning. I felt really messed up after that meeting because they talked about drugs the whole time and I had no drug experience. But thank goodness I went to another meeting that day and that talked about alcoholism and the problems, like the symptoms of alcoholism, and then also the solution to alcoholism in as AA practices. And that was the Jaywalkers group, and I made that my home group. And Marcy was there and encouraged me to find a sponsor. And she said that I had to actually ask someone to sponsor me. I thought somebody was just going to like volunteer and ask me, would I please be there? You know, no, that's not how it works. So I had met this woman and I said, well, I'm going to go meet with this person tomorrow up in Ashland. And Marcy said, yes, that's a great person. You should go there and ask her, you know, to sponsor you. So I drove up to Ashland. And it's so funny because the big sign, I swear, when I'm driving up to Ashland, this is on a Saturday morning, and I think I'm crazy for doing it. I mean, why am I getting up on Saturday morning driving up, you know, 30 minutes to go meet with someone I don't even know at a church I've never been? Like, it was just so crazy, but I was doing it. I was just doing it anyway. And I thought it just made no sense, but I was just, I mean, what did I have to lose, you know? But the sign said hangover, you know, 0.5, you know, 1 mile. And I thought, and like, oh, Hanover, you know, I mean, my mind was just playing tricks on me. There were nights when I'm going back and forth to the meetings and stuff. And I was going to meetings like every day. And I thought I saw a squirrel with a scarf on. And I'm thinking, oh, that squirrel has a scarf on. And it was crazy. And it was probably, it was like a property marker. Then, I mean, when I stopped drinking, some weird things happened in my brain, you know, and I just, it's good for me to know that my brain needed some healing. And then I also like ran over something in my sponsor's yard and I was so embarrassed by it. I didn't want to tell her I did it, but you know, she knew that I did it. And so then the next time I meet with her, I go, you know, that little glass, you know, bird bath that was, yes, it's cracked, Angela. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry I did that. You know, can I get you another one? And anyway, it was bad. I was doing crazy things. So then it was right around Christmas. And so my sobriety date is September 29, 2006. And we got into the holidays and she said, make sure you have exit plans when you go places, right? Exit plans. Like you have your car or you have someone who can take you home. And I go to New York City and I said, no, I am not going to go on the boost, you know, the cruise around the Statue of Liberty that's at like 11 o'clock at night, they take off and leave. And I said, no, I'm not going to go on that with you guys. It was a church group that went up there. And, a party in church group though, let me say that. And I said, I'm not going to go. Well, we get done with the concert. They were in a concert at Carnegie Hall, which was really nice. I mean, beautiful things were happening. And after the concert, I'm just supposed to go back to the room. And they said, oh, so-and-so is sick and that we have an extra ticket for the cruise in the harbor. Oh, come on, you can come. And you know, here I am 60. I mean, maybe 60 days sober, right? And I say, okay, I'll go because I want them to like me. And I get on this cruise around the harbor and they're just drinking and and dancing. And you know what? I'll bet you they're not drinking as much as I think they are. I bet they're just mostly dancing, right? But I wouldn't be able to dance like they're dancing without at least four drinks, because they were dancing. And I don't dance sober. I didn't used to. I mean, I didn't know how to dance sober. I didn't know how to be fun sober. And I go up on the top level of that cruise and I'm just miserable. And I'm stuck in this thing for like 2.5 hours. And there's no exit. And it's too late to call anybody. Lucky for me, there was this one woman in the AA rooms who had said, you can call me at any time, I work nights. And I did reach out to her, and I called her from that ship. And I was freezing cold up on the top of where there's no one there because it was so cold up there. And I called her, and she answered the phone, and we talked, and she said, you'll be okay. You don't have to drink. But I learned that that's what I did. When I get uncomfortable, they gave me all those phone numbers so that I could just call someone. And some people would say, you know, they put in the hours that you could call them. And that was really helpful to me. I still have one of the original books that a woman's meeting gave me. And it's just, I look at these names and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm still friends with some of these women. You know, we get have these like long-term relationships, these long-lasting friendships. And it's really cool. So that was just some early sobriety stuff. I started working the steps with my new sponsor and started looking at areas of my life that were unmanageable. And I started to, at first I thought, what in the world are you going to tell me about God? I mean, I've been going to Bible study and studying. I know all this. I mean, I doubt you could tell me a story in the Bible I hadn't heard, which is kind of, there's a lot of crazy stories in the Bible. And, you know, I do all this volunteer work at church. I'm in the choir, you know, and you're going to try to tell me about how to connect with God. I mean, you're preaching to the choir, right? That's what I do all the time, is connect with God, you know? And then she said, why don't you, she's like, would you be willing, that she always would use those words, would you be willing to, and that was a trick, just take everything that you think you know about, you know, God, and just set it over here. Just set it to the side for now. And let's go through all the steps, like new, like fresh. And then you can pull back the things off the shelf. She's like, you set all your ideas over here on the side. And then if they make sense, pull them back into your life. And that was non-threatening to me. You know, that was open-handed enough that I was willing to follow that. Because I had been doing a lot of work and Bible study and a lot of religiosity, you know. But there was the reason I was doing it is that I was seeking hard. You know, I was spending hours and hours and hours at church because I was seeking hard, but I didn't know that I was digging in the wrong hole, you know, like I was digging and digging and digging in the wrong place. But it was because I wanted the connection. It wasn't until getting with my sponsor and going through this step work and getting really, really brutally honest with her, with myself, I mean, and that's still a process I'm in right now, is being honest with myself, that I started to have some, I started to grow up, started to maybe mature a little. I started to take some responsibility for my actions. And I still was, so right around step three, I knew that was kind of like a turning point of like, am I going to stop here or am I going to keep going with the steps, right? And can I really trust AA? Can I really trust that this program is going to work? Do I really want to do all these things that you guys are doing? I don't know. And then I was driving down the road and it reminded me, just like when I was driving down the Madison Highway, you know, you've got two lanes and these cars are going like 45 miles an hour, opposite directions. And I'm totally trusting that person over there is going to stay in their lane. Right. And I'm willing to just barrel on down that road. And I'm going to trust that person over there is going to barrel down in their lane and stay there. I trust that all the time. Then I'm sitting on top of this. This is all of my kind of my third step stuff. I'm sitting on top of this roller coaster and we're up at the top, you know, hundreds of feet up, and we're hanging like almost vertically down. We're kind of falling into our seats. It just stops in place. And I'm trusting that machine to hold me, and I'm not going to die when it drops and drops down. So I started saying, I trust all these other things that maybe I shouldn't. I mean, I do though, I trust them. So why can't I just trust God? You know, why can't I just trust God the way I trust all these other things? And I started to kind of change my, attitude towards this program and what it asks of me. And I became completely willing to do whatever this program asks. And so that's my sponsor. And it started there. And we started going through the steps. And my sponsor knows everything about everything. So my sponsor knows about my work stuff. My sponsor knows about my checking account, any kind of like credit debt, car loans, house loan. My sponsor knows everything. My sponsor knows, like if I fess up, I tell on myself. So if I'm late to a meeting, I'll call my sponsor and say, yeah, I was embarrassed. I was late to a meeting. Why were you late? You know, and we'll talk about that stuff because I hate when I'm late to a meeting. It's a problem for me. So it's something that I want to improve on, and I have improved. But I don't try to pretend like I've got it all together, except, I mean, I don't have to pretend like I have it all together because I don't have to have it all together anymore, right? It's no longer important for me to have it all together or to look like I have it all together, but it doesn't mean that I'm perfectly happy with it either. And so I will tell my sponsor, and this is what happened, and this is what happened, and then we'll talk it through. And, you know, there's something that I'm supposed to be writing inventory on right now, and I'm a little resistant. I'm like, oh, no, I've solved the problem. I don't need to write inventory on it. We've already solved the problem. But I was asked to write some inventory on it, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write some inventory on it, you know. And just if anyone who's new or hasn't written inventory, it just is really an honest evaluation of where – for me, it's like, where am I dishonest? Where are my expectations dishonest? What am I doing wrong? You know, am I harming anyone? And then we learn through the steps, you know, that there's ways that we have that we can heal some of the damage that we've done. And that certainly, for me, has been most important in my relationships with my father, my mother, my half brother, his wife. And it was things I did after I stopped drinking that were the most damaging because I was so prickly because I hadn't done step stuff. So I want to tell you more like detailed stories, but I don't have time to. So I will tell you that I trust AA because for me, AA is how I stay more connected to God and to my fellows. I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful that I have this disease that requires me to seek spirituality. I mean, it's much better to seek spirituality than to seek a prescription, you know? So seeking this way of life is the prescription for me. That's how I treat my alcoholism. And it's every day. And we don't graduate. So it's so funny. And I'll end with this. We talk about like I'm the class of 2006. There's a few other people around my home group in my area in Bonilla. And we'll be like, oh yeah, class of 2006, meaning that that's the year we got sober. That's the year our life started again. You know, that's the year we were reborn. So you know how like in school, your class date is when you end school. And in AA, our class date is when we start, you know. And AA has been really like a new, like a second birth, like what they call it, born again, So it's like born again sober. And in a lot of ways it is. It's a rebirth. It's, you know, I am fun sober. I'm fun sober. You know, I know how to have a good time sober. I know how to dance sober. I know how to be goofy sober. all those things that I thought that I had to have a drink to do to be myself, I'm becoming more and more myself in sobriety. But it's thanks to this program, because there's no way that I'd be able to do this like with my church group, because you know the part in the book where it says, we hope you think these stories are not in bad taste. Well, I've told a few stories at Bible school and they thought they were in bad taste. So this is where I tell my stories, right? And you guys laugh and get it and you don't think it's in bad taste because you know I'm not that person anymore. But those lovely ladies, they're still afraid. They're afraid that my reputation is going to be damaged. I'm like, oh, we're way past that, you know? So anyway, thank you guys so much for having me. And I'm going to see some of you guys in Richmond soon, I hope.
All right. Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Mike.